The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 5 of this 7-day session in November 2014 here at Mountain Gate. And it continues to be all white outside. And for a while we had blue sky this morning and sunshine, but it's clouding up again. And it looks like we are going to have some more precipitation, although perhaps not a whole lot. We'll continue sharing the teachings of Kusan Sunim, the Korean Son Master, Son being the Korean pronunciation of Zen, who lived, I think he was from 1900, 1901 till 1980-something. So he lived a fairly long and fruitful life in a number of American Zen teachers, Son teachers, trained with him, and Western Son teachers. In particular, the most famous ones are Stephen and Martine Batchelor, who were both monks under his teaching at Songkwangsa, his monastery in Korea. He also went to the Rochester Zen Center at one point and called upon Kapler Roshi. I assume he was invited. That's usually the case. And there is a story about not quite exactly a Dharma duel, but something like that. A Dharma encounter between teachers, although I don't know that it was between teachers. I think it was between senior students of Kapler Roshi at the time and Kusan Sunim. And one of the students apparently held up an orange and said, "What is this?" And Kusan Sunim turned to his attendant and said, "Does he know what an orange is?" At any rate, so we can get a little bit too cute in our Zen combats. This talk that I'm going to share with you today is the first lecture from a winter retreat. First, a little bit more about Kusan Sunim. It turns out, actually, he was born in 1909, and his parents were farmers, and so the family essentially worked in the fields. And although his parents were Buddhist, he went to a Confucian school. There was a lot of Confucian schools in Korea, in Japan at the time as well. Confucians were scholars, and there was a period of time in Japan where the Confucian analects were known by every school child. And when he graduated from school, he became a barber and worked as a barber, married, and still helped on the family farm. But it says here in this book, The Way of Korean Zen, that from an early age he had periodically been drawn to the monastic way of life. Quote, "When I was 9 years old, I remember thinking, could it be possible for someone to be without birth and death? Was it possible to have unlimited powers to move freely through the sky and on the earth? Such thoughts made me want to go and live with the monks in the mountains, but the fear of missing my parents prevented me from leaving home then. When I was 20, I also considered such a life, but I was not sufficiently determined." But then, when he was 26 years old, he got quite ill, and this illness was apparently a tremendously painful one. And then a friend of his, who was a devout Buddhist, said to him, Since the abode of the self nature is originally pure, where does your illness lie? Where does your illness lie? And they had a great effect on Kusan Sudhim. So then he decided to go to a monastery to chant the mantra of Avalokiteshvara, of Kuan Yin in Chinese, which is apparently the mantra is Om Mani Padme Hum, which is what the Tibetan Buddhists chant a great deal of the time. And he wanted to do that for 100 days. And then he found himself to be cured at the end of that 100 days. This extremely painful illness went away. There are quite a few stories like this among Zen masters. In the case of the eminent Chinese master who died just a few years ago, when he was young, he also was born into a farming family, and the family was so poor that they had to rent their farm. They didn't even have enough money to own it. And it was his job to go out and pull weeds. Not to pull weeds, but to pull weeds so they'd have something to eat, because they had to sell all of their food. And he was the youngest child of the family, and clearly malnourished. And in fact, as he was growing up, he became a teenager, his parents felt that he was rather minimally endowed with intelligence. And so they were about to arrange his marriage to an also minimally endowed young woman, in hopes that the two could somehow support each other and they could survive together. When a monk came to visit, because his mother was a devout Buddhist, and suggested that instead they send him to a monastery, specifically the monastery where this monk, this abbot, was from. And so that's what they did. They sent him to the monastery, and it was there's a lot of intellectual endeavor in Chinese Zen monasteries. They're kind of complex. They also do the Pure Land chant, even though they're Zen monasteries. And there's a great emphasis on study as compared to meditation. When I stayed at that master's monastery in Taipei many, many years ago, the monks and nuns sort of wandered into sitting in the morning, maybe sat for 20 minutes, half an hour. But most of their day was spent in either teaching classes on Buddhism or studying Buddhism. They didn't do so much Zazen. They did have retreats. They did have Sesshin. And in his American center in New York, they did lead Sesshin, and he had a number of Western Dharma successors who taught Zen in much closer to the way we would expect it to be taught, with more sitting. But at any rate, so he went to this monastery as a teenager, and they were required to memorize all the chants and memorize sutras, and he had a devil of a time doing it. He just didn't have enough mental strength to accomplish this task, and so his abbot suggested to him that he do prostrations before Kuan Yin, 500 prostrations a day, and that he did. And after 3 months, suddenly he was able to do the memorizing without a problem, and he ended up actually getting a PhD in Buddhist studies in Japan eventually. Many, many years later, he had to leave China when the communists took over. went to Taiwan. Actually, initially he was inducted into the army there, and it took quite some work to get out of the army at a time when people who tried to leave were actually shot. But he and Kepler Roshi met each other in Japan and remained friends for the rest of Kepler Roshi's life, basically. It's not to be sneezed at, some of these practices. So, let's not spend any more time on Kusan Sunim's life and go right into this first lecture. And at the beginning, there's a poem. I made friends with the white clouds and gray storks who gently reply to the fresh wind and the bright moon. Unaffected by the passage of time, I remain bright and quiet while I sit. A bowl of porridge, a plate of wild greens, and a cup of tea. I smile. Very simple life. No extra stuff. Simply at one with the universe. No troubles. No self-doubts. No panic attacks. No anxieties around whether or not we're worthy, whether we make the cut in terms of society or society's expectations. But simply being able to live in peace and ease, even though there's not much to eat and even though there's not much to drink, but still being able to smile. I venture to ask the assembly, all of you who are endowed with the pure, undefiled, original nature, have you completely awakened to it or not? If by chance you have penetrated the profound meaning of the patriarchs, then say something. You may know the unchanging nature of seeing bamboos and pines in the snow. Do you understand the unchanging nature by seeing bamboos and pines in the snow? Well, the snow is going to melt and it's going to get warmer. The unchanging nature? What does he mean by that? Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. This is what it says in the Prajnaparamita Sutra. Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Can we see that emptiness within ourselves, that emptiness that is form? This is not a blankness, this is not a checking out. How can form be empty? Aren't we solid enough? Aren't we solid enough? So where's this emptiness? What do they mean by emptiness? And then he writes another, or reads another poem. With the cessation of defilements, there is no high or low place. The original pure face cannot be assailed. In ice, flames appear. The bright light is all pervasive. The subtle dharma, limitless as the sands along the Ganges, adorns the entire world. And then he continues, although many rivers converge in the sea, in the end their taste is one and the flow of their waters comes to an end. Likewise, defilements and false thinking endlessly flow from the conditioned mind. Defilements and false thinking endlessly flow from the conditioned mind. As we go deeper and deeper in our practice, we begin to see more clearly those defilements flowing from the conditioned mind. We begin to see that we have this impression of ourselves, and we hadn't realized how much it had driven our life, our reactions to life. And as we uncover each of these defilements, if you want to call them that, aspects of our false self, a self-image that we have created over time to cloak ourselves in an identity so that we can feel like we exist. So we begin to see holes in it. We can get a little unsteady. We can begin to wonder who we really are. If we're not that, then who are we? And we're tempted to try to substitute some other thing, some other identity in its place, and it's very, very important not to do that, but to rest in the uncertainty of it, in the anxiety of not knowing who you are, not being able to trust your thinking anymore. This is a very dynamic place, and it's important not to try to latch onto anything as permanent or as fixed. You know, if we don't have a self-image in the sense that we're talking about here, then we're not constrained in our interaction with life. Just think for a moment. Things happen to us as we grow up, and very likely, since we are at the moment here all Americans, we probably grew up with a rather negative view of ourselves, with a negative self-image. And as a result, when somebody interacts with us, we see that interaction through the lens of that insufficiency or that low self-esteem or whatever has been the product of that way of growing up, that conditioning. And we react defensively out of it. But if there is no self-image, there's no defensive reaction. There's no felt need to react in any given way, and instead there's a spaciousness that abounds in which we can respond clearly to what's going on rather than coming back at it with a knee-jerk reaction based on our misperception, which is based on our self-image. This self-image really causes us a lot of problems. So what do we do about it? A lot of the time we're not even aware we have one. But I can guarantee that if you're embarrassed at some point, if you get angry at some point, if you feel insulted at some point, this right there is an indication that you're attached to a self-image and it's being contradicted in some way. There's no self-image, there's nothing to be embarrassed about, is there? We're only embarrassed if we think we have been insulted or we have done something embarrassing. But who is this we? Who am I really? This is something to pour into your practice, whether it comes in the form of the Kuan Mu, who am I, my face before my parents were born, the sound of one hand, or simply the profound yearning that we drive the out-breath far out with. And we do this again and again and again and again and again, and we get bored, and we get frustrated. Sometimes anxiety comes up. Sometimes fear comes up. Sometimes irritation and anger come up. What opportunities? Right there is that illusory self-image showing its illusory face. Dive in, feel it. You can't argue with it. There's no point in that. That won't touch it. But if you feel that anxiety in your body, if you feel your face redden with embarrassment and the discomfort in your body, you can move forward even work more deeply into finding out who you really are in lieu of this self-image. And when we can go deep enough, we're freed from that self-image, at least temporarily. And of course, then we need to work on making it less temporary, so that in all our hours, we are aware and free of that self-image. And gradually it'll die in the vine, and we'll be born anew, a fresh life. But be careful, because there's always the temptation, especially in that uncertain point when you're beginning to see holes in your thinking, in your idea of who you are. There's going to be a strong temptation to try to find some security somewhere by substituting a self-image. Don't do it. Just keep working. Just keep your breath coming out stronger and deeper. Put the anxiety into the breath. Search for who you really are, the real truth. Don't try to substitute something else that's just as false as what you're trying to free yourself from. Likewise, defilements and false thinking endlessly flow from the conditioned mind. Due to this, we suffer beneath the wheel of birth and death. But when the mind from which defilements and false thinking flow is completely cut off, that doesn't mean we shut down. That means it's cut off because we've seen through it. Then high and low disappear. Common and accomplished beings vanish. Originally, all is equal. Therefore, the pure original face cannot be assailed. And then it seems like he struck his lectern with his staff. The pure original nature that is able to hear the sound and see the staff cannot be assailed. It does not undergo the suffering of birth and death. It is not stained by defilements. What is it that heard that sound? What is it that heard that sound? All of you who came to the monastery, what are you doing? Are you eagerly seeking fame and wealth? Are you seeking glory? Are you just looking for comfort? Did you come to the temple to live free from cares because life in the world is too difficult? Are you eagerly seeking scholastic learning? Are you eagerly seeking cleverness? You should not be here for any of these reasons. All the affairs of the world are just like dreams. With a single stroke of a knife, completely sever all concerns. Only search for awakening. Not only must you discard all worldly fame, wealth, glory, comfort, learning, and cleverness, but the Buddhas as well. You must finish with it all. An ancient master once said, quote, "The bright light of the mind has never darkened. From ages past to the present, it has been the brilliant way. When entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge," close quote. We have to move beyond words in order to find that truth. We cannot search for it through thought, through reading, for chatting, for going to lectures. The only way it can be found is by going inward and searching beyond the realm of thought, beyond the realm of words. That's where it will open freely to you. Words put up a barrier, just as big as a huge mountain that's standing in our path when we try to get beyond it. In the West, we're sort of given the impression that unless we're thinking or talking, we're not really working on anything. We go to school to learn a lot of words, a lot of concepts, some of which can be very useful and very helpful in our life afterwards. But we're taught subtly as well that the only way to solve a problem is through thinking about it. And yet there we have the example of Einstein, who by his own reckoning said that when he just simply sat down and allowed his mind to be deeply quiet, the answers to these questions that seemed to be such profound truths of physics simply came forth for him. He didn't think them out. He didn't reason them out. He went into that space beyond thought. And there's another thing that happens to us when we move towards a space between thoughts, which we will reach through the extended out-breath, finally, when we have practiced long enough with it. And it is presaged by fear. Because if we aren't thinking, are we going to disappear? Initially, it can be a frightening possibility. And in fact, the whole thing about Zen practice, as we get closer and closer to Kensho, is that we do likely feel that we will disappear, and in truth, we will. Who we think we are will vanish. Temporarily, at least. How long that is the case depends on how deeply we've gone. But when there's nobody there to be embarrassed, to get angry, to be frustrated, to be important, then we can really respond truthfully, fully, completely, freely to whatever is before us. This is the only real freedom there is. And it doesn't depend on environment. And it doesn't depend on being in a situation where we can do anything we want to do, as Jacques Le Seran proved in coming to his deep awakening in Buchenwald. This bright spiritual light, which is able to hear the sound and see the staff, has not darkened even once. Not once has it become a sentient being. Not once has it become a Buddha. For this reason, it is the way that is eternally radiant. Therefore, when entering this door, discard intellectual knowledge. After practicing for a while, you may come to think that you know something. Then you start conceptualizing. For example, if you've been meditating on no, you may think, that which says no, is that not it? Those working on what is this may think, that which says what is this, is that not it? This approach is wrong. Therefore, avoid speculative thinking. You must possess truthfulness and sincerity in order to practice correctly. To practice simply because others are doing so is just imitation. You won't achieve anything in that way. You must truly awaken in order to be freed from the suffering of birth and death. Knowledge and conceptualization are not appropriate. When you awaken to the genuine truth, you will stand out in the world and be called a supreme being. But of course, that's not why we go about that work. Such a person extensively benefits both the sentient and the non-sentient and is called a master of all things. Since that person brings the suffering of birth and death to end forever, they become the lord of the 10,000 things. When you investigate the Wado and intend to awaken to your great original nature, you must be like a hen hatching eggs. And this, when we talk about the Wado, as we said in Taisho the other day, this is the nub of the practice. This is the core of the practice. So if you are working on the koan, who am I? It is who. If you're working on the koan, what? Does a dog have the Buddha nature? You're working on mu. If you're simply and powerfully bringing your need to return to your true home into the out-breath, that also is your Wado. And the sense of needing to have an answer one way or the other is important. Although it will vanish, it will go underground from time to time. But have faith that it hasn't disappeared. When you investigate the Wado and intend to awaken to your great original nature, you must be like a hen hatching eggs. Think about how much effort the hen must exert in order to successfully hatch eggs. From dawn to dusk, she constantly pecks and searches for food. Imagine how hungry she gets while sitting on the eggs all day long. If she frequently leaves to eat or drink, only half of them will hatch properly. The rest will rot. While the hen is hatching her eggs, she does not just sit quietly. She moves the eggs around with her feet in order to evenly distribute the heat. Only in this way will the chicks hatch successfully. It is the same for somebody practicing meditation. Whether you are investigating what is this, no, which is mu, or the cypress in the courtyard, the practice will not mature if you just hold the Wado motionless. In other words, if you just do it mechanically. If you just watch it repeating, what is this, what is this, what is this, what is this, then you would be like a hen trying to catch her eggs without moving them. And this would be foolish. You cannot awaken in this matter. You must be like the hen who moves her eggs around. When Zhou Xu said no, what was his reason for saying it? You must inquire into this. Why did he say no? And this refers to, does the dog have the Buddha nature? That koan, that more or less most well-known koan in Zen practice of the breakthrough koans. A monk goes to the master, and the master happened to be Zhou Xu, Chinese master, a deeply realized Chinese master, whose temple still is an active teaching temple in China today. And in order to really understand this koan, you have to sort of put yourself in the shoes of the Chinese of the era, where dogs were considered such extremely lowly characters, dirty, filthy, and not the sweet little house pets that we use them for today. And this monk couldn't conceive of something that despicable actually having the Buddha nature. And so he goes to check with Master Joshu. Does a dog really have the Buddha nature? And Joshu says, of all things, no. Why does he say this no? The Buddha said, all beings are endowed with this perfect, clear mind of awareness I've just awakened to. All beings. He didn't say everybody dog, but dogs, or everything but dogs. He said, all beings are endowed with this true nature. So then why does Joshu say no? The dog doesn't have the Buddha nature. And to further complicate matters, a monk at a different time asked him the same question, and he said, yes, a dog does have the Buddha nature. Is he just a doddering old man? He did live quite long. Or does he know something that these monks didn't know yet? Form is emptiness, emptiness is form. Form is no other than emptiness, emptiness no other than form. Feeling, thought, and choice, consciousness itself are the same as this. can this be? How can something be and not be at the same time? That is the nub of that koan. It's the nub of every koan, really. When Joshi said no, what was his reason for saying it? You must inquire into this. Why did he say no? To express himself in words already spoiled it. What was his state of mind prior to uttering no? Sitting still, merely keeping the wado in mind, is not correct practice. It is just like, quote, watching the tree waiting for the rabbit, close quote. There's a story in Zen about a farmer who was clearing his field one day, and a rabbit came racing by and ran into a stump, and it was such force that it knocked itself dead. And so the farmer was quite happy that he had a dead rabbit he could take and sell. Made more money than he could in a day of working his fields. And so from then on, he sat next to the stump waiting for the next rabbit to come and bump himself off so he could sell that one. You must diligently investigate with a mind willing to endure even the crushing of your bones. What is this? What is it like? Is it long or short? You must continually penetrate into the question with a profound sense of inquiry. By maintaining such a practice for a while, you may enter an empty state whereupon body, self, and world disappear. But the practice is not solely concerned with reaching this state. The Buddha expounded the doctrine of emptiness because of the disease of existence, but this doctrine is not the only teaching. Emptiness can also be a disease. To only remain in this state is comparable to polishing a tile with the hope of transforming it into a mirror. Thus, to simply watch emptiness is also a disease. Existence and emptiness can both be diseases. So where does that leave us? If form is emptiness and emptiness is form, and both can be problematic, what then? Dive into that out-breath. Give yourself so completely to that out-breath, filled with a yearning to know, to be free, to truly know who you really are. To let go of this painful self-image. And do this again and again and again until you disappear, and then you will find out. We have to disappear, and then we have to be reborn into the world of form, understanding finally that form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And then, of course, we continue with the long maturation and with the advanced practice going into subsequent koans to deepen and broaden our initial kensho experience. Always alert to where a habit pattern is coming up again. And the possibility then lies with letting it go, so that your whole being is transformed, body, speech, and mind, through that awakened state. Only when that has been completed, when there's nothing left hanging, not a shred of self-identity, no traces, only then can we be considered to be enlightened. And that is a tall order, one that not so many people are willing to endeavor to embody in this day and age of impatience, quick results. But in terms of the suffering in the world, it's vital that we do this. Absolutely vital. And this is our bodhisattva vow, to come to awakening for the benefit of all beings, not just, as Haruo Roshi would say, for our own self-satisfaction. So I think that is long enough for Teisho today, and we will continue tomorrow. We are quite a ways through the Sesshin already. You all have been working very hard. Turn up the heat a little bit more. Your capacity has increased since you've been working hard on your practice for these 5 days. So you can put greater commitment and greater strength and greater intensity into it. This does not mean to strain in your practice. It means to give yourself to it so completely that you forget who you are. Thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the 4 vows.